Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Condoleezza Rice, the piano-playing, weightlifting, high-fashion Secretary of State, is right where she wants to be, at center stage. And there's plenty of drama. The Mideast peace effort, Iraq, Iran, China, North Korea, a new Russia. In the balance, the Bush legacy and her own. The New York Times' Elizabeth Buemiller is just out with a new biography that chronicles Rice's journey from segregated Birmingham, Alabama, to the halls of power, and she's here to give us an inside perspective. This hour, On Point, Condoleezza Rice's bid for history. Joining me now in the studio is Elizabeth Buemiller, Washington reporter for the New York Times, a longtime Beltway reporter. She began her career at the Washington Post. At the time, she covered the White House from September 10th, 2001, to mid-2006, when she began working on a book. That book, Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, came out yesterday. Elizabeth, we last spoke with you when you were leaving the White House beat. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on the book. You conducted extensive interviews with Condoleezza Rice and I think about 150 of her colleagues and her close friends and critics. Is there one particular trait that emerged in your research and your reporting that really defines her?
I think it's her discipline and her focus and her drive. Those are three traits, but they're all related. And she learned that from the very beginning, from parents in Birmingham who made Condoleezza Rice the project of their lives.
So how did growing up then in segregated Birmingham, Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement affect her, broadly speaking?
Well, it's essential to who she is. I mean, we're all products of our childhood and upbringing, but what an upbringing and childhood that was. On the one hand, she was the product of three generations of educated of Rices before her and raised on the other side. And so her parents made sure she had French lessons and ballet lessons and tap lessons. And when she went to etiquette classes, learned manners, learned how to dress. Later she took a class in modeling, which she said to me was actually quite helpful, and she uses it to this day. You can sort of see when you look at her. But also her parents, and also the value of education, her parents insisted she be in book clubs and that she read. And on the other hand, Birmingham was a very rough environment, and she grew up under segregation. She lived in a parallel society to the white world.
And she actually knew one of the girls who was killed in the 1963 bombing at the 16th Street Church.
She was I wouldn't call her a close friend, but she was certainly a playmate. Denise McNair attended the Presbyterian Church kindergarten in Condoleezza Rice's father's church, Westminster Presbyterian. So they were playmates. And yes, Condoleezza Rice was sitting in a front pew at Westminster Presbyterian in September 1963 when she heard a big noise. And that was the bomb going off.
And that was sort of a dividing line in her childhood.
That's absolutely, because before then it was possible to keep a child like Condoleezza Rice isolated, to protect her from the ugly world out there. But after that, she went to the funeral. She attended. It was the first funeral she ever attended, and her parents took her. Martin Luther King delivered the eulogy that day. It's a famous eulogy. If you read it today, it will bring tears to your eyes. Mm. There were three coffins. One of the girls' parents did not participate in the joint funeral, but there were little coffins up front of the church, and she stood outside and listened from the outside. She couldn't get in; it was too crowded.
Fast forward many years. I was so interested to read in your book the relationships that Condoleezza Rice developed once she got to Washington, and specifically in the inner circle at the White House. I wonder if you'd start by describing some of those relationships, first with Vice President Dick Cheney.
Well, it's very contentious. That was the one surprising thing I took away from my reporting. We all know she had a rough time with Donald Rumsfeld, that there was at times that was a relationship of mutual loathing. What I didn't know as much was the conflicts with Cheney. From the very earliest days, she had to fight for turf against Rumsfeld and Cheney. Bear in mind, she had 2 years of mid-level White House experience when she became National Security Advisor. She had only worked for 2 years in the George H.W. Bush administration as a Soviet expert on the NSC staff. She was in charge of corralling, herding the elephants in the room. That was Cheney, Rumsfeld, Colin Powell. And people who defend her say that almost no one could have done this job, but it was tough going. And with Cheney, from the first days, he was determined to play a central role in foreign policy. He went to the president in early 2001 and said he wanted to run National Security Council meetings in the president's absence.
Right.
Well, that had always been the National Security Advisor's job. And Condi Rice had to go to the president and say, no, Mr. President, this should be my job. And he sided with her.
Hmm. What does that say about their relationship? The fact that he often stands up for her. He stands behind her. You mentioned in the book that she's his confidant and his soother and his many things. That
right.
is a very complicated relationship.
It's a very complicated relationship. I don't know if it has any I don't know whether you call it familiar. I don't know what you call it. But Andy Card, the White House chief of staff, said to me the president loved Condi. He said, now, I don't want you to take that as sexual or emotional, but I think it was emotional. And the result was that she did not push the president in the first term to do – she did not raise dissenting opinions with him. She did not challenge him. And I also think he didn't push her as much to do the job he needed her to do.
In fact, you say in the book that in her role as National Security Advisor during the first term, that she acted more like a marketer than a counselor in many ways.
Well,
she failed in her basic part of her job to offer dissenting opinions.
Right. She did. There's no evidence that she raised any major objections to in the run-up to the war with Iraq, or raised objections about or questions about the evidence about weapons of mass destruction, which we of course now know didn't exist. She saw her job. When I interviewed her, actually, even before this book, I interviewed her for an article in the Times, a profile of her, and she defined the job of National Security Advisor as translating the president's instincts into policy. Mm-hmm. So to take his sort of musing it's about the world and create Bush administration policy. Now, Henry Kissinger did not see the job. When he was National Security Advisor, he saw it very differently. He mm-hmm. saw it as driving policy.
Mm-hmm. What about her relationship with Colin Powell? You tell an interesting story in the book about Powell's chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, who was astounded at one meeting that he attended, Rice hounding Powell about Iraq's supposed weapons of mass destruction.
This was in early February of 2003, when Powell was preparing for his now infamous presentation at the United Nations Security Council about what we know about Saddam Hussein and Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And it was a very, very tense time. This was in a Sunday evening at the CIA, in a conference room at the CIA. And Powell and Wilkerson were going over line by line the brief they had been presented by the White House to present to the UN. And they were very suspicious of a lot of the claims in it. They thought it was hyped. They thought it was hysterical. And they were trying to get it down. They were trying to make a presentation that they felt was accurate. And Condi Rice came to the conference room, as there were other administration officials there as well, and really said to Powell and questioned Powell and said, is that the best you can do? Can't you make it better? This is all from Wilkerson. And Wilkerson was so put off by this young woman, in his view, you know, questioning the Secretary of State, that he had to leave the room because he thought he was going to say something.
Mm. And what does that say about Rice and her personality and how she deals with those that she works with?
Well, she can be extraordinarily charming and extraordinarily impressive, and also vulnerable. She can also be really, really tough, and she's the daughter of a school teacher, and she can lecture people, and she can press people and become very emphatic and make her points. I mean, it's as a woman, I have it's harder for a woman to be really tough in a corporate setting, in a political setting, but she is, and mm-hmm. It's noticed.
You brought up Donald Rumsfeld. In your book, you say he viewed her as a glorified Russian studies graduate student who was not up to the job.
That's true. Donald Rumsfeld looked down on a number of people, not just because I wouldn't say he singled out Condi Rice, but bear in mind, he had been defense secretary already once before, and he had had vast experience in government. And he felt to some degree that, and he was right, that her expertise was in a one very specific area of the world, the Soviet Union. And she did not know as much about the Middle East and about other parts of the world. so, but you know, Andy Card also said that Rumsfeld and his dealings with Condi Rice was a little bit sexist and a little bit old school. So,
you also say that Condoleezza Rice would send aides to the Pentagon as spies to find out Rumsfeld's battle plans for Iraq.
Well, this is one case where their bad relationship, which, you know, on one hand is sort of the stuff of soap opera, had serious policy implications and national security implications. Here it is, few months before this massive invasion, before the war in Iraq, and Condi Rice was not able to find out, you know, troop levels, any number of critical facts about the coming war. And here she's national security advisor. So she had three people on her staff, two military aides, and one of them would go put on his uniform and go over to the Pentagon and pretend as if he were visiting friends and spirit away documents. They also had access, because they were military, to classified Pentagon computers, and they got information that way. Now, she says, when I talked to her, she was reluctant to blame Rumsfeld. She said very carefully, well, you know, that's just the Pentagon. But she didn't deny it. It happened.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Joining me in the studio is Elizabeth Buemiller, Washington reporter for The New York Times. She's author of Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, which came out yesterday. I want to play a clip at the top here, Elizabeth. During Rice's January 2005 confirmation hearing as the Secretary of State, Senator Barbara Boxer accused Rice of overstating the threat that Iraq presented on the eve of the war, and said that her invocation of a mushroom cloud unnecessarily frightened Americans. Here is Rice's response.
I have never, ever lost respect for the truth in the service of anything. It is not my nature. It is not my character. And I would hope that we can have this conversation and discuss what happened before and what went on before and what I said without impugning my credibility or my integrity.
Elizabeth B. Miller, in your view, does Secretary Rice have a problem with the truth? And what degree does her strong loyalty to the president play in all this?
Well, I first like to say you found the right soundbite there, because you can hear the real rancor in her voice. Barbara Boxer got under her skin, and that's as close as she comes in public to showing, you know, real anger. But I think, you know, and from her point of view, she would argue no. And I think you can say that, you know, she's either there's no evidence in my book or what I found that she knowingly lied about something. But I think that what she did do, which the whole administration did, was that she looked at only certain parts of the intelligence. And, you know, in the run-up to the war, there were differing views within the government about the threat of weapons from Saddam Hussein, and she looked at the estimates from the CIA. And at the same time, this is about the aluminum tubes, about whether or not these tubes would be used for nuclear weapons. And the CIA judged that Saddam was trying to get them to make nuclear weapons, and the Energy Department said no, they disagreed, they didn't think so. She looked at the CIA estimate.
I want to play the now famous, infamous statement about Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction programs.
The problem here is that there will always be some uncertainty about how quickly he can acquire a nuclear weapon. But we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
Will that be the soundbite that forever defines her? I mean, what was her defense in retrospect of that particular line and the imagery that she used there?
Well, it's the title of one of my chapters, "We Don't Want the Smoking Gun to Be a Mushroom Cloud." That's going to be one of the things that follows her around. Her defense of that, well, first of all, the story behind that is that this was in September of 2002, and this was the beginning of what Andy Card referred to as the marketing campaign that the White House and administration were going to sell the public and the Congress on war action against Saddam Hussein. And she had heard this phrase in a meeting of this group of of White House officials who were trying to move forward with the war in Iraq. And she had heard this from Michael Gerson, the chief White House speechwriter, and she liked it. And so I think she was the first one to use it publicly on CNN. And I asked her about it. Do you regret using it? And she said, no, that's what we thought at the time. I do regret that it was taken as such an explosive comment. That's as far as she went with that.
So that was September 2002.
Right.
In your book, you talk about a conversation December 2002 between President Bush and Condoleezza Rice, where he asked her point blank about the war. Can you recall that?
Sure. She recounted this to me. She was in the Oval Office with the president, the two of them, as often happens. She was in the Oval Office six or seven times a day. He would call her down. And in this case, he asked her, do you think we have to do this? Should we do this? And she said yes. And, I questioned her heavily about this because I said, were you aware of the importance of the moment, of the history of the moment? She said, yes, I was. But I also have to say that at that point, war was inevitable. It didn't matter what she said. The administration by that point had been, there was a massive buildup of American troops in the Gulf, as we now know. And I think the administration had reached the point of no return. And there had been a series of steps over a number of months leading up to that December point. So she could have said no. I don't think it would have mattered.
I got to go to the phones. Milton from Florence, Massachusetts, has a question about this period of time in the White House. Hi, Milton.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. It's good to be on the show.
Good. Welcome.
I'm having a question. Maybe it's about Condoleezza's character, and it goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan, just in the nature of whether someone could be cynically manipulative or whether they are sort of innocently manipulated either by themselves or by others. A good salesperson has to believe in their product, and the smarter you are, the better you can fool yourself. Some of us believe that Cheney and Rumsfeld, were going there for war, and that the administration's continuing to pretend that they made a mistake when, in fact, everything's going according to plan. And I'm wondering if your guest can speak to what Condoleezza Rice's role might be in light of those kinds of suspicions.
Milton, thank you.
You mean specifically, did she believe in the war and believe in what she was doing at the time? Is that the question?
Well, I'm trying to pin you down and make you choose between she was duped by others, she fooled herself, or she was cynically manipulating the public with the rest of these folks. And I know that's not fair, but there I am doing it.
Okay. Well, I guess if I had to pick one of those three choices, I would say she fooled herself. She wouldn't say that, but that's what I would say. She was completely behind the war in Iraq. She believed in it. She thought that Saddam Hussein was a threat and had to be dealt with. And she also, and this I find interesting, what we don't know, we'll know more later, but what we do know now is that every morning after 9/11, the president and Condi Rice and George Tenet and Dick Cheney sat down with a daily threat assessment, which was a compilation of the last 24 hours of all the threats against the United States. And I think you can't underestimate or overestimate how this affected their minds, their psychology. They were determined never to have another 9/11 on their watch. And I think first of all, they were blindsided by 9/11, and they lived in fear it would happen again. And so every morning they're getting these threats coming into the White House. The first thing the president sees every day, the first thing Condi Rice sees every day, it's sort of raw intelligence. And I think that was also what was driving them, that if there was the slightest bit of threat with Saddam Hussein, even if we don't know everything, we can't take any chances again.
You mentioned the meetings that Condoleezza Rice and George Bush had many, many times a day. I think we often view them as very different people when, in fact, you say they're very much alike.
That's right. I mean, I argue that other books have said, well, they're so different. The president is intuitive and impulsive, and Condi Rice is a disciplined academic. I think on a deeper level, they're sort of soulmates. I mean, that both are products of American elites. George Bush from the Northeastern WASP Republicans, East Coast establishment. Condi Rice is a product of a very proud Southern professional African-American class. And so they both, on the surface, are supremely self-confident, but they harbor deep resentments underneath. I mean, Condi Rice, like the president, has been underestimated her entire life as an African-American, as a woman, and for many years as the youngest person in the room.
You described Rice in the book as loyal and calculating and stubborn and hesitant to reveal feelings and almost incapable of admitting a mistake. And you also say, you mentioned a little bit earlier, but I want to go in on this point a little bit, that there was an element of rage in her that she doesn't talk about or really even acknowledge. But how is that revealed?
Well, I think First, I'll answer the last question first. The element of rage, I argue, comes from it's based on growing up in a racist society. I mean, she grew up under segregation, and while she says, and there's a lot of truth to this, that she became stronger for it and rose up above it, and it's part of what made her so tough and powerful today. I also think that there's these moments of rage and anger that come out about it. One of my favorite stories in the book is where she is at a jewelry counter at the Stanford Shopping Center, and this is after I don't remember whether she was provost or just a merely successful professor at Stanford at this time, but the point is she was a very successful woman, and she asked the clerk to show her the jewelry, and the clerk brought out the costume jewelry. And Condi Rice said, no, I would like to see the good jewelry. And the clerk got huffy and said something under her breath. And Condi Rice then said, in the words of a friend who witnessed the entire incident, "Let's get one thing straight. You're behind the counter because you make $6 an hour," or whatever it was. "And I'm asking to see the good jewelry because I make considerably more." And there you have it. I mean, that's a remarkable story to me. I mean, also, the other point is that she, growing up in Birmingham, I mean, there's another famous story where she was 6 or 7 years old. Her mother took her into the finest department store in Birmingham, and she was trying on a dress, and the sales lady said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Rice, you can't try on the dress in the dressing room. Blacks are not allowed to use the dressing rooms. You have to use the storage room." And Mrs. Rice pulled herself up and said, "My daughter will try on this dress in a dressing room, or I will not spend my money here."
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. And Pete, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Pete. Welcome.
Yeah, my question, and I guess it's a comment at the same time. I mean, I like Condoleezza Rice, but from watching her and seeing her going back and forth to the Middle East, I really don't see anything that she has accomplished that you could really give her credit for. And the other question is, too, how are you going to have a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians when you don't even include Hamas? I mean, I really don't see how history is going to really view her that well when there's really nothing you can really point to and say, you know what, she did this, she accomplished this. I mean, she's a very bright woman. I give her credit for that. I like her, but quite frankly, I really don't see any real accomplishments in the Middle East and, for that matter, any other place other than the fact that she works with George Bush.
Pete, thank you.
Help me with that. Thank you.
Okay, well, I think you could say her accomplishments so far are, number one, she really has changed our diplomatic relations so far with North Korea. She right now, I mean, in February of 2007, North Korea agreed to shut down its main nuclear reactor in exchange for $400 million in aid. That was because she had persuaded the president, and also because she had an excellent negotiator, Christopher Hill, that we should work diplomatically with North Korea. So I think, and you know, she has diffused so far a really serious crisis. I thought it was fascinating today and yesterday that the New York Philharmonic, of all things, is now traveling to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, for a concert in February, and has said they're going to play the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, I think that's extraordinary. Secondly, I think she did change U.S. policy on Iran. She persuaded the president over a number of months, but culminating in the spring of 2006, that we should offer to talk to Iran as long as Iran was willing to stop enriching uranium, which leads, as we know, to the development of nuclear weapons. Now, that was a major shift in U.S. policy, and that was her doing. The president was reluctant. Of course, we haven't talked to Iran because Iran has not stopped enriching uranium, but she did make progress there. And I also think that you can give her credit for Annapolis. Now, the peace conference in Annapolis last month, that really was her party. And she got 49 nations together to agree to move forward with a peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. It's a very long road ahead. I agree with you. Chances are minimal, but I think you have to give her credit for that.
Here she is at Annapolis, giving an upbeat assessment of what had taken place and what would happen in the future, and she cited progress on a number of diplomatic fronts.
The Annapolis Conference has thus been the beginning, not the end, of a new, serious, and substantive effort to achieve peace in the Middle East. This work will be hard. It involves risks and sacrifices for all concerned. But today's events have demonstrated unambiguously that the international community will fully support the path the parties have chosen. President Bush and I have pledged the unwavering support of the United States to realize this goal. Peace between Israelis and Palestinians is a national interest for the United States.
Is this a banner issue for her in the last 14 months in office?
This is the most important thing that she has to do for the next 14 months, yes. And a year ago, she decided this had to be done. There had been, to be charitable, there had been fits and starts, but mostly a lot of fits and policy drift on the Middle East in her 7 previous years. And she sat down, she took a bunch of documents home from the State Department during Christmas break to her apartment at the Watergate and sat down and looked at previous U.S. efforts in the Middle East and how they'd all failed. Then she sat down with Tzipi Livni, who was the foreign minister of Israel, and the two worked out a general plan to bring together Prime Minister Olmert of Israel mm-hmm. and President Abbas, the Palestinian territories, to talk to each other in a room.
Tell the story along these same lines of her reaction to the election that brought the militant group Hamas to power, would you?
Well, the U.S. had been pushing for elections in the Palestinian territories in January of 2006. This was part of the president's plan and Condi Rice's plan to spread democracy in the Middle East. Well, what happens if you have an election and the wrong party wins, at least from your point of view? What happened was that Condi Rice had not expected Hamas to win, and she was so blindsided by this that she was she had gone home the night before thinking that Hamas was doing better than expected, but it was probably not going to win. And then the next morning she was exercising on her elliptical trainer at 5 a.m., as she often does, and was watching the cable news crawl across the bottom of the screen, and she saw as she was exercising that, you know, Hamas wins, and she thought, well, that can't be right. So she kept exercising, and the crawl continued, and she finally got off the elliptical trainer and called the State Department and said, what happened in the election? They said, oh, Hamas won. And she said, oh, my goodness, Hamas won. And so, not knowing what else to do, she placed one more call and then thought, well, it's going to be a really long day. I might as well get back on the elliptical trainer and finish exercising.
So what's your takeaway from that story?
Well, my takeaway is that there were a lot of people at the State Department and in the government, including, I should say, Elizabeth Cheney, who was an official of the State Department in those days, who warned her not to push the elections right then. The Israelis did not want the elections. The Palestinians did not want the elections. She thought it was the right time to go ahead, as did the president. And she really thought that Fatah, the moderate party, would win.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Joining me in the studio this hour is Elizabeth Buemiller, a Washington reporter for The New York Times. She's author of Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, which came out yesterday. Do you know if Condoleezza Rice has read this?
She has a copy. The State Department asked for I had one copy right before Thanksgiving. Random House sent me my one copy because it just hot off the press, literally. And I was getting calls from the State Department, so I said, okay. So I dropped it off for her. I know she took it to Camp David that weekend. I haven't heard what she thinks. I mean, I think she will not like parts of it, and she'll like other parts.
Mm-hmm. to the phones now to begin this segment with Ken, who's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you all?
Fine, thank you. What's your question?
Okay, two parts. One, Condoleezza, what does she plan on doing in the private sector, if so? And two, and more fascinating, I think we all have a sense about her that there's more to her than what we've got. And like the CEO part of her, the part where she's actually in charge making her own decisions, not that she didn't do that under the Bush administration. And it's really interesting that, in a way, that Bush administration is a lot like her upbringing and her family. So she was pretty much designed from birth to be able to survive in that administration, and she did it quite well and still accomplished things. So the part I want you to focus more on is, if she were to run for a political office, first, does she have the aspiration to do that? And secondly, would a lot of her beliefs and stands be the same as the Bush administration, or would you suspect they'd be different, or you don't know?
Thank you, Ken.
That's a good question. She has actually, one thing I learned in writing this book is that she's far more political than people realize. She had talked about running for Senate from Colorado someday, way back when she was a graduate student at the University of Denver. She stunned one of her professors when she said she wanted to be a senator. Later, Pete Wilson, after he won the governorship of California and had to give up his Senate seat, he talked to her about filling his Senate seat. This was in 91 when she was at the Bush 41 White House as the Soviet expert, and she considered it. He didn't formally offer it to her, but he certainly talked to her about it. I talked to him about it, and he said he was seriously considering her, but she didn't take him up on it ultimately because she would have had to have run for re-election 2 years later, would have had to have raised $20 million and most likely would have lost. And so she did it. But more recently, her staff has talked openly about the fact that she would be interested at some point in running for governor of California. Arnold Schwarzenegger is up and he's finished in 2011. There was a lot of talk a year, 2 years ago about perhaps she would be have the vice presidential spot on a
right.
GOP ticket. That has really died down, I think, because of the unpopularity of the administration and her role in committing the nation to war in Iraq. I think she would be a big target on the GOP ticket. Mm.
Tell us about her mentors, Elizabeth, who they were and how they influenced her.
She's had a long series of mentors. They are all older white men. But before I go on, I should say the reason they're all older white men is that there weren't a lot of young black women in national security and foreign policy and military policy when she was coming up, as we say. Her first mentor was Joseph Korbel. He was a University of Denver professor and Madeleine Albright's father of all people. Condoleezza Rice was struggling to find a major after she gave up piano. She had trained to be a concert pianist and realized when she was 17 that she didn't have enough talent to really make it. And she was struggling to find a major when she wandered into his class in international relations one spring at Denver. And he gave a lecture about Stalin and the Byzantine politics and power of the old Soviet Union.
And that
she
fascinated her. One of her mentors, former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, once made a reference to her and his grave disappointment in her. Was that difficult for her to take?
She had a difficult relationship with him after in the run-up and after the Iraq War. He was very opposed to the war. As you may remember, he wrote an article, an opinion article for the Wall Street Journal opposing the war and any American invasion in the summer of 2002. And she felt blindsided by it. And she also, so they had a tough conversation. She was very upset about it. Didn't tell me, but he certainly has told friends that he doesn't know what happened to she was never a student, but to his baby, his disciple, as one of his friends put it to me.
The bulk of your reporting in the book is about Rice's professional career, but you also do some interesting reporting on her personal life. Does she have one?
Oh, yes. I mean, she doesn't drive the carpool and take, you know, kids to Boy Scout meetings. But
yeah.
She doesn't. She's never married. She had plans to marry a player for the Denver Broncos, Rick Upchurch, when she was a graduate student at the University of Denver. That was one of the great loves of her life. It lasted about a year. And for the last 25 years, she has had an on-again and off-again relationship with a man named Gene Washington, who is the director of football operations for the NFL in New York. They started dating when she was at Stanford, and they've dated in between his marriages. And he now visits her in Washington. He has been her guest at Camp David for Thanksgiving weekend last year. He's her escort at dinners. I can't help you out much more than that.
I was looking at some of the pictures in the book, and she has a real sense of style. You look at some of the photos, from her clothes to her personal image. How much attention does she pay to that?
She does. She's very honest. She said she likes to shop. She doesn't shop as much as she used to. She told me in the old days before 9/11, when she was national security advisor and she didn't have quite the security she does now, that she has to get into her car and drive up to Saks Fifth Avenue in Chevy Chase not too far from the Watergate and shop on Sundays. And her, you know, clothes were always very important in her life. Her mother was beautifully dressed,
yes.
Angelina Rice. And Condi Rice was beautifully dressed as a child. There's a picture of her in my book where she's 8 years old on the summer of 1963, standing outside the White House, and it's unbearably hot, you can tell. And she says she remembers that day being very hot, but she's in this immaculate little white sleeveless dress with patent leather shoes and a charm bracelet and a bow in her hair, you know, a perfect child.
I want to read a clip from your book about this particular subject. Would you set it up?
Yes. You want me to read this?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Yes.
This is, I was on this trip. This was a big trip right after the 2004 re-election, and it was the president's first big trip to Europe to try and mend relations with the Allies after the war. And this was... The substance of nature of the trip was that the U.S. had moved, it had inched toward changing policy and talking to Iran. But on February 23rd, we were in Germany, and Rice was the warm-up act before the president here it begins. On February 23rd, in an appearance before American troops in Wiesbaden, Germany, Rice wore a long military-style black coat that blew open to reveal a skirt just above the knee and a pair of sexy high-heeled black boots. The troops greeted Rice with raucous shouts of, "We love you," while the rest of the world buzzed about the Secretary of State's new dominatrix look. In quotes, Rice looked as though she was prepared to talk tough, knock heads, and do a freeze-frame matrix jump kick if necessary, the fashion writer Robin Givhan observed 2 days later in the Washington Post, referring to Keanu Reeves in the long black coat that he wore in the action film The Matrix. Who wouldn't give her ensemble a double take, all the while hoping not to rub her the wrong way? Rice, who by this time was back in Washington, was both flattered and flustered by the new attention. "Why are these people writing all these stories about my boots?" she asked Wilkinson, who was a top aide. Wilkinson, uncomfortable, he was also a little younger than Condi Rice, said he didn't want to say. "Condi, I don't know how to say this gently, but it's because men like those kind of boots. They think they're sexy." Rice, who was amused that Wilkinson felt this needed to be pointed out, whispered back, "We know that."
I want to go to the phones again. After that, Shirley from Sterling, Massachusetts is on the line. Hi, Shirley. Welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a brief question, which I can take the answer off the air, if
okay.
you, please. I was wondering, I find Condoleezza Rice's public speaking difficult to listen to. She either sounds scripted to me, or she sounds wavering and uncertain. And I wondered whether she had any formal training in public speaking, and if not, does she take pointers on it now from anybody in particular? Mm.
Thanks, Shirley. Interesting question.
Not that I know of. You're right. She's extremely cautious in public. She doesn't like to get off of her talking points. She knows she was trained and spent many, many years as an academic. So there's not a great deal of spontaneity in her public presentation. And you're the second or third person to note this sort of tremble in her voice. I should have written about it because other people talked to me about it, and I meant to put it in the book, and then I forgot. It's that simple. But I think she gets nervous before some big events. I'm just thinking back to my book. The most nervous that I know that she ever was before performance was before a public appearance was before her testimony to the 9/11 Commission in March of 2004, and she was really on the line about the clues that she had missed and the administration had missed before the 9/11 attacks, and she was going to be grilled. And one of her aides told me that he looked in to see her before she went up to the hill, you know, to go to feed her the lions, and she was had her head down and her she was praying. And, you know, she's the minister's daughter, and she was doing that's what she does in moments of crisis.
Let's go back to the phones now, and David, who's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, David. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Great show. I love to hear your topics each day. I'm just interested in knowing whether the author has any comparison and contrast between the styles of Secretary Rice and former Secretary Colin Powell in her book. They both seem to be very strong-willed persons, but I don't see myself as a citizen. I don't see Condoleezza Rice willing to oppose President Bush on issues the way Colin Powell seemed to be. And that's my question. I'll take the answer off the line, please.
David, thank you.
Well, that's a good question. You know, if you talk to Colin Powell these days, he will tell you that a lot of what Condi Rice is doing right now as Secretary of State are things that he pushed for in the first term and couldn't get anywhere with Bush. There are two reasons for that. One is that that was not where the president's head was in the first term. He was waging two wars. He was not focused on diplomacy. But he also didn't have the close relationship with Powell that he has with Condi Rice. The president, even though Powell is a great figure in American life and is a war hero and a general and highly regarded around the world, the president was suspicious of Powell in many ways. He felt that Powell was sometimes more interested in Powell than he was in the president. And there's not that issue with Condi Rice. One of her most enduring attributes is that she is loyal.
And that's what the president prizes.
Right.
Yeah. Back to the phone. Steve is on the line from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if the guest had an opinion as to Condi Rice's standing relative to other secretaries of state. In history, I've heard her called the worst secretary of state in history, the worst secretary of state in the last 100 years. I just wonder how she ranks her compared to other secretaries of the past.
Steve, thanks. What about it?
I think what you're referring to is that she was called the worst national security advisor in history by one of the weapons hunters in Iraq. So far, you may know something I don't know, but I think so far we're not yet sure how she's going to rank as Secretary of State because she's not done yet, and there's a lot still on the table in the next 14 months as we talked about. You know, I think that if she makes some sort of a deal in the Middle East or is able to make some kind of progress, if North Korea really does give up its nuclear weapons, it'll be fair to judge her a great success. If nothing happens, she will be seen as an interesting but minor Secretary of State who did too little too late.
Bob on the line now from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Bob. Welcome.
Hi. I was just wanting to see what Ms. Rice's attitude might be toward her being called by the, you know, all the cartoons and the calling names from the left wing that she's not being true to her race by being a conservative Republican.
Well, her answer to that is that it's a big tent and that the black community is not monolithic and that you can certainly be a black Republican. I should point out that she was once a Democrat. She voted for Jimmy Carter in 1976 and voted as a Democrat for Reagan in 1980. But by 84, when she was registered as a Republican, she was nonetheless advising Gary Hart on foreign policy in his presidential campaign that year.
I'd like to ask you as we wrap up here, Having interviewed Ms. Rice myself several times, I am struck when you meet her, sort of the feelings that are evoked, and I wondered what your personal thoughts were about her as a person and as a leader.
Well, if you interview her, as you know, it's hard to break through the shell. I had 8-hour-long interviews with her over the period of a year. And there was a couple interviews I can say where I thought I broke through and that I could speak to her as, you know, person to person. The reason I think I could do that was because we weren't talking about current policy. On current policy, she's very cautious.
Right. And what will you take away from after your research and your reporting about this presidency and her job as Secretary of State?
Well, I hate to waffle here, but I think the jury is still out. So she's a better Secretary of State than she was National Security Advisor, that's for sure. And I think here's what I will take away. You cannot understand this presidency or this president without understanding her.
Elizabeth Buemiller is a Washington reporter for The New York Times. She is author of Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, which came out yesterday. Thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.